This is the introduction for Decatur, Part 1.
Hello, this is Todd Durakon with the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, January 14th, 2020. Already the second full week of January. And I've had a very mild winter so far, so knock on wood that this continues. And I saw the other day that it was probably 3 days ago, 67 days until spring. So enjoying this mild winter. We start with our first article on the front page under the education heading. Engaging Families, Shelbyville Schools event has something for all, including pizza. Sounds great. This is by Valerie Wells from Shelbyville. School district leaders, local businesses, and even students from Eastern Illinois University are uniting in Shelbyville to plan a new family event that promotes literacy, family meals, and social and emotional wellness. The event on Tuesday, March 31st, doesn't have a name yet, but they're working on that. We have an idea for a family engagement event, and hopefully we'll be able to come up with a more clear title, said Ryan Scott, principal of Main Street School in Shelbyville. We haven't really named it. The planning group met for a second time on Monday to iron out more details about the evening, with activities scheduled from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Parents will be able to drop off their kids at Shelbyville High School, where the kids will get a free taekwondo session, crafts, and a talent show, while parents go across the street to Moulton Middle School, where they'll be able to hear a keynote speaker and take their choice of several breakout sessions on topics like stress management, the role of sports with youth, kindergarten readiness, and family recreation opportunities at Lake Shelbyville. After the event, when parents go to pick up their children, each family will receive a large free pizza from Monocle's or Joe's Pizza in Shelbyville, which they can take home for dinner as a family, Scott said. We're going to ask them to post a photo of their family on social media with the hashtag #EatTogetherReadTogether, Scott said. Organizations involved in the planning and execution of the event include Piercy's Taekwondo, the two pizza restaurants, Shelby County Mental Health, HSHS Good Shepherd Hospital, the Army Corps of Engineers, and several teachers and staff from the district schools. Anytime we share social and emotional strategies, the kids get excited about it, and they want to go home and share them with their families, said Angie Kelly, who teaches at Main Street and is the Positive Interventions and Support Tier 1 leader. Kids who learn healthy coping skills at a young age do better in school and in life, Kelly said. By offering parents training and helping their kids and themselves develop those skills, everyone wins. Another group involved in the planning is the Rural Teacher Corps at Eastern Illinois University. That group, made up of students studying to be teachers, university faculty, and representatives from small districts, works to encourage youth, young teachers to seek positions in rural districts. Dakota Crowder, a senior at Eastern, said she wants to teach in a small district because she came from one herself. She grew up in Charleston. Helping with the event in Shelbyville is a way to be involved in a small district's success. It's all about the community in a small town, Crowder said. Scott told the group at Monday's meeting that academics are important and he's proud of the district's accomplishments in that area, but he doesn't want them to stop there. Our base model is to turn out a good person, he said, motivated and proud to come from Shelbyville. And some photos that accompany this article. Main Street School Principal Ryan Scott runs the meeting for planning the upcoming March 31st family event at Main Street School in Shelbyville, and he's standing before what looks like some adults in front of a classroom whiteboard, a dry erase board. And another photo of Principal Scott with a larger view of the same photo. Adults sitting around clusters of desks of four in a classroom. Looks like a very nice classroom, very colorful. And Tanya Bowery left and Maria Clark Wright go through the plan for today's, for Monday's meeting for planning the upcoming March 31st family event at Main Street School in Shelbyville. All right, we move on to the next article, which is the pump house, group hoping to save structure, taking case up ladder. Save the Pump House writes to Tate and Lyle CEO, seeks meeting. This article is by Tony Reed from Decatur. The battle to save the former A.E. Staley manufacturing company Pump House looks set to shift to London after Decatur-based managers for British-based Tate and Lyle, the current owners, said they plan to press full steam ahead with their demolition plans. Leaders of the Save the Pump House group, fighting to preserve the structure, told a public meeting Monday night that they now have written to Tate & Lyle's chief executive Nick Hampton requesting a meeting, and will meet him in London if they don't want. And we'll meet him in London if they want. We'll meet him wherever, said Brett Robertson, the Save the Pump House chairman. Robertson warned that demolition of the pump house posed a public relations disaster for Tate and Lyle, and said if local management isn't interested in talking, maybe the man at the top of the company would be. Tate and Lyle confirmed plans to demolish the century-old structure off US 36 in August. The Save the Pump House group launched in the following months and has taken its case to Decatur City Council members and the company's leaders. Robertson on Monday was reacting to a letter from Chris Olson, Vice President for Community and Government Affairs for Tate & Lyle, which essentially told the Pump House supporters the company did not want to save the building. We maintain that the safe and swift removal of the Pump House remains the responsible course of action, said Olson. He said the deteriorating condition of the building, built in 1919 and disused for pumping water to the crop processing plant, must be categorized and respected as a risk. Olson continued, at its core, this structure is an industrial building with all the safety issues inherent in an industrial building of the era. Falling from heights, uneven surfaces, constrained access, open water, the safety of our people and the community is our highest priority, and delaying plans for safe deconstruction is simply not something we are willing to compromise on. The U.S. Corps of Engineers, Rock Island District, has to sign off on the demolition, however. Robertson said they are aware of Tate and Lyle's letter and plan to talk to the company about it. Robertson had fired a letter back to the company, copied to the Corps, asking them to reconsider their hardline stance and save their shareholders a lot of money. As a former public company executive and a Tate & Lyle shareholder myself, I cannot imagine that spending over $500,000 on demolition is a prudent use of shareholder resources if other solutions are viable, his letter said. The $500,000 price tag is the Save the Pump House Group's estimate of the demolition price. They have proposed a multi-phase plan to gradually restore the structure, the once lavishly decorated upper floors, of which were used for hosting public events and parties. Robertson said shoring up the building and fitting it with attractive exterior lighting, phase one, would cost around $65,000. Robertson said public support had gotten the effort to try and preserve the pump house rolling. Now he said that public pressure must switch to distant London. He urged people to reach out to Tate & Lyle and its chief executive with emails and comments funneled through the LinkedIn professional networking site, which is used by Tate & Lyle. The company email address is mediarelations@tateandlyle.com. We have got to try and move this public outcry to London and create that dialogue, Robertson said. If we get 2,000 people appearing on Tate & Lyle's social media and sending emails, they will notice us and they will respond to us. The 40-strong audience at the meeting house in the Decatur, the 40-strong audience at the meeting hosted in the Decatur Public Library appeared in broad agreement with him. Audience member Karen Larson, 78, said much was at stake. That pump house building is not duplicated anywhere, and if we lost it, we lose a part of our history, something that is unique, she added. And some photos that accompany this here. There's a tight shot of a side view, and caption says, crews are preparing the Staley Pump House shown on January 3rd for demolition. And let's go to the first photo here. This is a much wider shot of the pump house, but also the surrounding area. Same description here. Okay. On to Decatur Schools Board set to vote on new boundaries. This article is by Annalisa Trofimuk from Decatur. School board members on Tuesday are expected to vote on Decatur School boundary changes that have been in the works for almost a year. A map of the district's website shows the proposed boundaries the board will be considering when it meets at 6:30 p.m. at the Keel Building. The proposal, created with the help of 20 community members and district officials, was presented to the board at its December meeting. One of the goals behind reworking the boundaries is to address inequities that exist in the current boundary system, which could prevent some students from attending schools in their neighborhoods. District documents say that measures to reconsider the boundaries was required under its BOLD, all uppercase, bold facilities plan to consolidate 22 schools into 17. The district also held meetings with parents and staff throughout the development process. At the December meeting, Assistant Superintendent of Support Services, Fred Bouchard, said the school boundaries haven't been evaluated in over 20 years. According to the district's website, there have been nearly 20 meetings at various Decatur School District campuses since August. While officials have shared details about Tuesday's meeting on its social media accounts, no letters were sent to parents and guardians, Chief Communications Officer Dennis Swarthout said. District documents show that the new boundary system, if approved by the board, would have a phased-in implementation. Students who live in the new boundaries for Dennis or South Shores, but who do not currently attend those schools, would have the option to move in August or stay in their buildings for another year. The plan also includes the closure of Durfee Technology Magnet School, taking effect in the coming school year. Those students would be assigned back to new boundary schools, or families could apply to a different magnet program, the district said. The boundary committee's recommendation also includes turning Hope Academy from a magnet school into a boundary school. Dennis School students would be spread over two campuses, addressing issues of capacity at the popular facility on the city's west side. New boundaries will apply to all new students, including kindergartners, in August. Next year, in August 2021, all students will be assigned to their new boundary schools, the district said. Students and families can go through an appeals process to stay at an existing school that is outside the new boundaries. The website also includes the following disclaimer about the boundary map. If your student or students currently attends a school outside of district number 61, you are not impacted by these inside district boundary changes. The district pledged in documents to provided for the board to communicate frequently with parents, families, and the community before and during the boundary transitions. The communication will include conversations, an online website, online form to submit questions, frequently asked questions, document, videos, a fact sheet, and letter to parents, and a podcast. Those with questions can send an email to welisten@dps61.org. In other business, Tuesday, the board also will consider allowing Because Life Deserves Design and O'Shea Builders, Inc. to seek bids for the addition of two classrooms at South Shores School as part of the BOLD facilities program. The board also will consider roof repairs to Baum and Oak Grove schools. Top Quality Roofing of Mount Zion submitted a bid for $87,300 to make the Baum repairs. The money for the repairs would come from the district's Health, Life, and Safety Fund. WTI Tremco submitted a bid of $15,481 to repair leaks in the roof at Oak Grove. The money to repair the roof, which was replaced in 1994, would come from the district's Operations and Management Fund. And there's a sidebar here. If you go, what Decatur Board of Education meeting, where? First floor boardroom in the Kiel building, 101 West Cerro Gordo Street, when? 6:30 tonight. And online, there's a boundaries map at dps61.org. There's also a photo of this map. And I believe that's all of the images with descriptions in this article. And we continue on to page A3, which is the local and state section. Man charged in woman's stabbing. Police victim stabbed with a kitchen knife while holding son. 1. Tony Reed, Decatur. Police said a Decatur man who stabbed a woman twice in the chest with a kitchen knife, inflicting the wounds as she held her one-year-old son in her left arm, has been jailed on preliminary charge of attempted murder. Terrence L. Calhoun, 22, was arrested around 1 a.m. Saturday and also booked on preliminary charges of endangering the life health of a child, aggravated domestic battery, and resisting obstructing police. Preliminary charges are subject to review by the state's attorney's office. A sworn affidavit from the Decatur police said the woman had been arguing with him in her apartment in the 500 block of West Decatur Street with her daughter, 3, and a baby son present. She states, Calhoun punched her twice in the stomach with a closed fist, said police officer Tyler Nottingham, writing in the affidavit. He stated something to the effect of, if I can't have you, no one can. Nottingham said a struggle ensued between the two before she grabbed her son and fled out to the stairwell to call police, pursued by Calhoun. Calhoun shoved her backwards against the wall and stabbed her twice with a kitchen knife, once in the area of her right ribcage and once in the lower left torso, added Nottingham. She later stated that based on Calhoun's statements and actions, it was clear he was attempting to kill her. He said the stabbing attack was seen by a 25-year-old female witness who then managed to pick up the baby in order to try and protect him, and she also seized the knife after Calhoun dropped it. As the witness did this, she observed Calhoun grab the victim by the leg and drag her down the stairs to the next landing, said Nottingham. Calhoun is then described as fleeing after other residents of the apartment building stepped in to stop the assault. Police later found Calhoun in the 800 block of West Macon Street and said he was caught and arrested after trying to flee. Questioned later, Nottingham said he told the officers, I didn't mean to do it, I just blacked out. He would not elaborate on what he did not mean to do. The victim was later treated at Decatur Memorial Hospital, where she was found to have 2 1-inch-wide stab wounds that a doctor told police were not life-threatening. A check of Macon County jail records Monday night showed Calhoun is being held without bond. New details in high-speed chase that led to arrest. Tony Reed, Decatur. New details were revealed Monday in the police chase, which reached speeds of 100 miles per hour, that led to the arrest of a suspect wanted for attempted murder in Decatur. Jaquez L. Jones, 20, was taken into custody at 3:38 a.m. Saturday. He has since been booked on a preliminary charge of attempted first-degree murder for a shooting that occurred Thursday afternoon in the 200 block of East Olive Street. It left a 20-year-old man with life-threatening wounds, according to police. Jones was being sought on a warrant. A sworn affidavit from Decatur police said he was later found and taken into custody at his home on West Macon Street after the Saturday night chase ended and he had fled on foot. The pursued pickup truck had been found abandoned just north on Forest Avenue. Police describe Jones as the driver, and he was also booked on preliminary charges of aggravated fleeing and eluding and resisting and obstructing peace officers. All preliminary charges are subject to review by the state attorney's office. The affidavit said two passengers in the truck, an 18-year-old man who had ridden in the front and a 22-year-old man who sat in the rear, were tracked down by a police dog. They had been found hiding in an enclosed porch in the 1300 block of West Forest Avenue around 9 p.m. Saturday. The affidavit said police seized a box of 18 live 40 caliber bullets from the front door pocket near where the 18-year-old had been sitting. He was then booked on preliminary charges of the possession of ammunition while having no FOID and resisting obstructing police. The 22-year-old man riding in the rear seat was not listed as having been booked on charges, and police did not immediately return a call seeking comment on his status. Writing in the affidavit, police officer Christopher Scalon said the vehicle chase had begun at 8:23 p.m. Friday when officers tried to pull the truck over for a traffic violation on West North and North Pine Streets. Scalon said it initially stopped and then fled as officers approached the vehicle. An extensive chase of the vehicle ensued, during which the Ford F-150 pickup traveled at speeds in excess of 100 miles per hour, greatly increasing its distance from police, added Scalon. He said police found it again as it was turning northbound onto McClellan Avenue from Forest Avenue before discovering it abandoned with the doors standing open. A check of Macon County jail records showed that Jones remained in custody Monday night in lieu of posting bail set at $5.75 million. The 18-year-old's bail is fixed at $325,000, which means he must post $32,500 to bond out. And there's a very nice photo of five Canada geese here on the water. Destination ahead, it says. Canada geese glide through the water on an overcast Monday at the Walmart East Retention Pond in Decatur. And some good travel news here. Chicago to Decatur flights to start in March. SkyWest to operate twice daily additional flights to O'Hare. Garrett Karsten, Decatur, SkyWest, will begin offering twice daily flights from Decatur Airport to O'Hare International Airport starting Monday, March 5th. It was announced Monday. I'm sorry, that is not Monday, March 5th. Starting March 5th, it was announced Monday. My apologies. We are excited to be a part of the Decatur community and look forward to providing reliable, convenient air service, said Greg Atkins, SkyWest Airlines Managing Director, in a statement. The St. George, Utah-based airline replaces Cape Air, which had provided flights to Chicago and St. Louis for the past 2 years. Flights to Chicago leave at 6 a.m. and 9:25 p.m. daily, with additional departures at 10:45 a.m. and 12:12 p.m. on Sundays, Mondays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays. The federal U.S. Department of Transportation in December selected the air service to receive a subsidy through the Essential Air Services Program. SkyWest will get $2,993,168 in a contract that runs from February 1st to January 31st, 2022. The federal program provides funds to ensure commercial air services in less populated areas of the country. The board of the Decatur Park District, which oversees the airport, recommended SkyWest. The 50-seat jets can help reach a goal of 10,000 enplanements in 1 year for the district. Hitting the goal would qualify the airport for $1 million from the Federal Aviation Administration towards infrastructure goals. The goal hasn't been reached since 2006, but the Park District said it's obtainable, citing the jet service potentially flying around 31,200 passengers per year. And there is a photo, a beautiful photo in the sky, kind of taken from the planes, maybe 5 o'clock. And it's just a beautiful photo of the plane. White with a blue tail. All right. On to the final article on this page. Club Car Wash to open on Pershing. The bubble wrap moves to new home. Scott Perry, Decatur. For the past several years, the sign at 303 East Pershing Road has promoted the same month-long Christmas token sale for the defunct Sparkle Clean Auto Wash. With the bays boarded up, the car wash staging area became home to the very popular burrito truck. Later this year, the site will begin the next chapter in its business life when it becomes home to the new Club Car Wash. Demolition of the concrete bays already has taken place, and the neighboring building that most recently was home to the bubble wrap will meet the same fate. They will be replaced with an automatic express car wash, the kind that pulls your vehicle through the cleaning bay, coming out bright and shiny at the other end. The Decatur location is one of four listed as coming soon in Illinois on the company's website, clubcarwash.com. Other locations will be in Bloomington, Jacksonville, and Peoria, which already has an operating club car wash. The Columbia, Missouri-based company also has locations in its home state and Kansas, and is in the process of rebranding its existing Tiger Express car wash locations, said company spokesperson Mercedes Chaon. As for the bubble wrap, the business has since moved to the former Taco Bell building at 2801 North Main Street, next door to Salsa American Burrito. I like this place, said the bubble wrap owner, Tony Hall. So far, we have been doing very good here. This is the third location for the business since Hall took over the former My Shipping Place, moving for a short time to a storefront along Martin Luther King Jr. Drive before returning to the original Pershing Road location in 2018. Hall said the new location is very convenient and that he has already seen an uptick in new customers. Hall said the new location also offers more room for the services it provides, which includes shipping, packaging, postal, fax, copying, freight shipping, and laminating. It also offers various office, shipping, packaging, and moving supplies. In addition to the commercial clients, Hall said the business is benefiting from customers who sell items on Facebook and eBay. Hours are 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday and 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Saturday. Call 217-791-6826. The owners of the burrito truck announced their indefinite closure in Decatur at the end of the food truck season in November. No additional details were shared at the time. We continue on page A5 with the local and state section. Decatur schools, district set to reassign specialists to classroom, superintendent last resort move. Valerie Wells, Decatur. District administrators held a meeting on Monday with support staff to reassign them to teach in classrooms, a response to an ongoing educator shortage. The district has been unable to fill more than 70 positions in its schools, Superintendent Paul Friegau said in a statement. He announced plans to reassign instructional specialists who work throughout the district, mentoring and modeling effective strategies for teachers, reading recovery specialists who provide extra help in reading for individual students, and some alternative education staff who work at Harris School. Employees in these categories are typically certified teachers with advanced training. Friegau cited the nationwide teacher shortage plus a shortage of substitutes as driving the difficult decision to place those staff members back into classroom positions. They will be placed in the buildings with the highest numbers of unfilled positions, he said. This move is a last resort, but we know that we need to take drastic steps to ensure we're meeting the needs of our students, Friegau said in a statement. District leadership values the work done by our support staff who will be reassigned, but we know that they will make a difference in our schools that have the greatest need. The reassignments will take effect on January 22nd, he said. And that brings us to the end of our first half hour. Please stay tuned as we'll return with the second half hour in just a moment.